Great.
Does it work? Thank you.
The Senate Committee on Transportation will come to order. We've got a long list of bills again today. And once again, we have to be out of here on time today. There is another committee that follows us. Senator Stump, you're first on the agenda, and thanks for being patient. We definitely wanted to get you up and out of here last committee hearing, and we just couldn't make it. So thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I was here last time, and I know you had a busy schedule, and it's a busy committee. But I have a proposal that I would like to bring to your attention and hopefully your approval. And that has to do with, it's called an enhanced driver's license. And the enhanced driver's license is a result of what happened by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. And as you know, after June, or maybe it's July 1, we will have to have a passport in order to go in and out of the United States, and even to Canada or to any other country, Mexico, you will have to have a passport on you to get back in. And I had worked for many, many years on a committee. It was the Canadian-American Relations Committee under the Council of State Governments. And our goal was primarily to figure out how we could encourage the relationship and between our two countries, primarily Canada and the United States. And the reason, my district borders Canada, both Manitoba and Ontario, and we have numerous relations going on back and forth between the Canadian government and our Canadian provinces and Minnesota or North Dakota or any state really. They're our closest friends, they're our largest trading partner, and we frequent them very often, whether it's to go to Winnipeg, which is just an hour north of us, or whether it's to go fishing in their country, or whether it's for the Canadians to come down to Grand Forks or Fargo or Thief River Falls to shop. We have a lot of business. We also have a lot of manufacturing that takes place across the border, and it's frequent because many of the manufacturers, such as Articat and Polaris and Marvin's, a lot of their factory approach and processing is based on a time as needed type product. So what has been developed is what they call an enhanced driver's license. It allows you, by using this enhanced driver's license, which basically is a driver's license issued by the state of Minnesota, to have a chip, a radio chip embedded in that license that would, when you go through the immigrations at the border, allows them to identify that you are a United States citizen. And that's the only thing it does. It operates like a driver's license. It operates with all of the benefits and restrictions as of a driver's license. But it has the identification of a United States citizen in that. And so the federal proposal, which is that Western Hemisphere Travel Initiative, is something that's quite important. There is a handout, and I don't know if you have it in your packets or not, but it's entitled Passport, Please Avoid Border Hassles by Planning Now to Get the ID You Need. And it's from the Los Angeles Times. It's a very interesting article and complements, I think, the legislation that you have before you. Passports are more expensive. They cost $100. the driver's license. The enhanced driver's license would be a little more expensive than a traditional Minnesota driver's license, about $15 more expensive. And you would be able to go on ground, not in air, back and forth and use that. There are a number of states that have initiated this. Washington, Vermont, New York, Arizona, Michigan, North Dakota, Texas. And on the Canadian side, almost all of the Canadian provinces that border the United States have initiated the same approach. British Columbia, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, Ontario, Quebec, and five other provinces are considering that. So we have an opportunity, I think, to kind of dovetail into the new state contract that it will be issued, and I believe, Mr. Chairman, you probably know the timeline of that proposed contract for someone to make the license, Minnesota license that we have, and so this would be a good opportunity to do that, and this could be in people's hands so that within a relatively short period of time they could use this enhanced driver's license for going in and out of Canada or another country. The legislation is explained. It might be good to say what the legislation is not. It is not what they call a real ID or anything. It is strictly a enhanced license and only identifies your U.S. citizenship. Mr. Chairman, I think maybe that would be a good point to stop and see if there's any questions.
Senator Stump, I think that there's an amendment for your bill.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, there is.
Okay, Senator Scoy will move the A1 amendment.
In our packet.
Senator Stump, you want to explain what the amendment does?
Yes. Mr. Chairman and members, it's the A1 amendment, and lines 1.2 to 1.13 is a technical correction. It updates the proper costs, and as you can see, those are laid out on the amendment. And then lines 1.14 to 1.16 provides language to make the enhanced driver's license more secure for counterfeiting. The anti-counterfeiting laminate is a clear plastic film that goes over the license and allows that police officers can use a special light to read it. And then 1.17 to 1.20 is a provision that ensures an applicant will be provided with the information indicating what is contained in this license so that they have information up front. And I might add at this point that this would be totally voluntary if you wanted to get one of these enhanced driver's licenses. Mm-hmm. It's not something that's required.
On the A1 amendment, Senator Dave? Nope. Okay, on the amendment, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail. Senator Dave.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Stump, I like your bill, but if this bill goes through and we pass it, does this mean then that I can go across any crossing in the United States to Canada?
Senator Stump.
In other words, whether I was at, you know, anywhere, whatever crossing, North Dakota, Washington.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Day, that's correct. You could go into any foreign country, Mexico, Caribbean, you name it, and back and forth with this without a passport.
Senator Rest.
Senator Stump and Senator Day, it's for land crossings, though. I mean, if you flew into Canada or if you flew to Mexico, you could not, you would have to have a passport. But, you know, the people that go into Canada on a regular basis, for example, 40% of them do not have a passport because they would never think of getting on an airplane. They just do their daily business back and forth, or they go hunting there, fishing, and they have no need for a passport because they don't do international travel. It would be a real convenience, I think, this bill. Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Stump, thank you for bringing this forward. Well, I represent the people in Minnetonka and Plymouth because my family's always had property up on the Gunflint Trail and in Cook County. I think of those folks as well as people that I watch out for, and so I think this will be very important to the people who live along that border to be able to go back and forth because sometimes they don't even know ahead of time they're planning to do that. So thank you.
Is there anybody else? Oh, Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Stump, I like your bill. I just have a question about what they have to have in order to complete the application. I'm reading on page 4, lines 6 through 9. They have to have United States citizenship, date of birth. I'm assuming that's a birth certificate, Social Security number. But then you ask for a photographic identity document. I mean, is this like they'll have to have a passport almost in order to get this? Because what other kind of photographic identity document would they have?
Driver's license.
Well, they're applying for a driver's license.
No, but they have their old one.
One at a time here. Senator Scoy.
Mr. Chair, so Senator Stump, they would use their old driver's license as that photographic identity?
Senator Stump.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Scoy, yes, the idea is that when you renew your license, let's say, and my license will come up in May for renewal, it won't be ready by that time, but I could go in and I could buy, with an extra $15, I could buy this enhanced driver's license.
Okay, thank you.
All right. I think we're going to hear from Ms. McCormick now. And Ms. McCormick.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Pat McCormick, Director of Driver and Vehicle Services. And as any time you could either be renewing your license or you could be getting what we call a duplicate license, which you would then request an enhanced driver's license at that time. So you would have your photographic license. The department does have the ability to pull up the current DL photo if you have a license as well, and for a duplicate license, not for a renewal, we take pictures for a renewal. So, but we always verify the license photo with the photo of the person in front of us as well as what the person is on the card. So we do try to do that so that we can prevent identity theft of any kind and make sure the person is who they say they are.
Ms. McCormick, on the overall scope of the bill, are you going to be able to implement this?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, right now we haven't determined if we are going out for a new driver's license contract or if we are going to renew our current driver's license contract. If the legislature and the governor enacted this law, then in any either renewal of our contract or new contract, those requirements for this particular kind of license would be added to that contract.
Okay. And Ms. McCormick, your department's not going to have a problem implementing this if we push forward, right?
Mr. Chair, we have worked with the authors to ensure that it's workable within our current system. We would have to do rulemaking to identify these different identification requirements, so that would be part of it, and I think we outlined those things in our fiscal note.
All right, thank you. And that's the reason why the bill gets to go to judiciary, is because of the rulemaking, I believe.
No, Mr. Chairman, it should come to state and local for rulemaking.
Oh, okay. Well, we're going to judiciary next, and then I guess state and local. So.
Right.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wanted to be clear. I think we're in policy committee, so, but I have a fiscal question.
Go right ahead.
The amendment with the fees, does that change the fiscal note? Does this pay for itself now?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stump.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Dibble, yes, it does.
Great. Thank you.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Stump, just I guess I'm not seeing it in what I'm looking at here, but in the first page here, this summary, it says has technology and security features approved by the Homeland Security Department. Maybe you talked about that already, but could you go over that one more time, what those features are and technology that's included in here?
Senator Stump.
Mr. Chairman, and I believe I'm just going to try to...
Mr. Chair and Senator Dahl, in terms of the requirements, the issue would be the radio frequency identification that you have to have on the card, and that number is randomly selected. It isn't a number that would identify a person. There's no data practices issues with that. It is just a number that would also be listed as an enhanced driver's license, so as you're going over the border, you don't have to stop and go through the with the border patrol and show your ID. It's especially important for commercial drivers that are driving trucks, where then they can just go through because that number syncs in with their system, and that's the reason for that technology on the card. But every state that has an enhanced driver's license has to have an agreement with the Department of Homeland Security because of the fact that they operate the borders. And so when they talk about the Department of Homeland Security requirements, those are requirements that are part of their federal regulations that all states have to meet, and there's a regular agreement that has to be signed by the state with the Department of Homeland Security so that you're abiding by their regulations.
Oh, here we are.
Mr. Chair, then, Ms. McCormick, that's the only piece of technology that's in the card?
That's Mr. Chair and Senator Dahl, the RFID is the basic technology that you use to identify that individual as having been authorized to have an enhanced driver's license that allows them to cross the borders.
Okay, and Mr. Chair, Senator Stump, if I recall correctly, you said this at this time anyway is a voluntary. We only those that choose to take on this enhanced driver's license have to, right?
Just Mr. Chairman, Senator Dahl, yes,
Senator Stump.
That's correct. It is totally voluntary. Okay. It's just, if you want to purchase that or have that type of a license, and as Senator Rest mentioned, there's many along the borders, both on the Canadian side, and that's the reason they're doing it in the provinces, as well as along the northern borders and the southern borders. The states, many of the states are pursuing this because the interaction of trade in the case in my district, farmers that go back and forth, tourists that come back and forth on a daily basis. We have a lot of Canadian citizens that use some of the hospitals along the border because it's farther to go to their hospitals inside of Canada than it is to come into the United States and use some of our hospitals. As well as Ms. McCormick mentioned, the commercial traffic, a lot of the parts for making snowmobiles and ATVs and stuff come out of Winnipeg for those companies along the that are in that northern tier. And so the traffic back and forth is there's a lot of it. And so this facilitates that rather than having each individual have a passport.
Thank you.
Senator Day. Mr. Chairman, do either one of you, I like your bill, but do either one of you know why hasn't this been like a federal bill where you would have a passport for $100 and then another passport that's just a driving passport that was like 50 or 40? Why is it being done by states and not Homeland Security going to the federal government and somebody passing the bill?
Mr. Chair and Senator Day, from what I've read and from different discussions with other people in the association that DVS belongs to, the AMVAS association, I think the main reason is for states' rights. The states have the right to license individuals that are driving in their state. And that really isn't a right that's given to the federal government. And so that's why it has to be optional, and the states and the Department of Homeland Security have to agree with the program that particular state has, because they realize that it really isn't under their purview to be able to make those licensing decisions.
Okay. Mr. Chairman,
Senator Day.
Like a passport, you'd need to have a driver's license along with it, right, to go into a Canada or wherever. Okay. Thank you.
Senator Stumpf and Ms. McCormick, you know, it said in this one write-up that we have that, and it Ms. Berezovsky showed me in the statute, that it talks about the to enter by ports of entry from the Caribbean or Bermuda. And now, from what I understand, you don't, you know, for instance, going to Puerto Rico, you don't need a passport because that's American territory. But then you can go in and out of Puerto Rico with this particular identification to other parts of the Caribbean,
7.10.
As long as it's by sea.
7.10 in the bill.
Well, Mr. Chair,
McCormick.
Because Puerto Rico is with U.S. jurisdiction, the same licensing, Puerto Rico has that ability to issue driver's licenses as well. So what this is it's not like you're going to have two licenses. You just have the one license, but it also serves as a document that you can use into going to other countries over, you know, via land. So that's what it is. So you're still going to only have one license. You won't have an enhanced and a regular driver's license. And
Mr.
so that
Chairman.
Would be the same for Puerto Rico.
Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd just like to clarify, too, that this is not a document or this is not a license to get out of the country. This is the license is to come back in the country. Several years ago, I went to Montreal for something or other, and I still thought all I needed was my driver's license. And when I got to the airport, here were all these people with their passports. And I said, well, I'm only going to Canada. I don't need a passport. Well, it turns out that 6 months prior to that, you did need a passport. And I said, well, what can I do? And they said, well, you can leave the country, but you will not get back in. And so it wasn't a matter of getting on Northwest Airlines and flying to Montreal. That was fine, in which I did. And then I had my passport FedEx to me so that I could get back in the country. It's not the leaving that the United States cares about. It's the coming back in. So it's, you know, Canada, for theirs, doesn't care about their citizens leaving. They care about them coming back into Canada that they do so with a legal travel document. The driver's license is a privileged document that is that's used for identification. The passport or the enhanced driver's license is, in addition, a travel document. So there is that distinction. So if you had a Minnesota enhanced driver's license and you were in Puerto Rico, you could go to other places. You would only use your Minnesota one. And it's not leaving Puerto Rico that's the issue. It's getting back into Puerto Rico or any other state in the United States. I think that's something to keep in mind about any of these programs that other states have adopted as well.
Senator Dalton, we're going to move along.
Very good. One quick question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there any concern with this little more ease of crossing the border for any kind of smuggling purposes of whether narcotics or weapons or anything like that? Is there any increased concerns there because of this?
Senator Stump.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dahl, I don't see how other than, the security is actually not going to, I mean, it's the same, and I don't know why it would be any different. I mean, it's not, you're going to go through the same border crossings and you're going to talk to the same customs and immigration people.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, Senator Stump, so they're still doing the checks and everything. This is just going to speed the process up a little bit. They don't have to check all your papers and everything else or passports.
This is the paper.
This is more, Mr. Chairman, this is more of a personal, makes it a little bit easier for people not to have both a passport and a driver's license. And the other thing that it's been, that's pushed it is the Homeland Security, or Congress, actually, Congress passing legislation that says, in 2009, in order to leave the country and come back, you have to have a passport, period. Okay. And a lot of people in proximity to Canada and to other countries, we're not like Europe where everybody carries a passport because you're going in and out of different countries. And here, this makes it easier from the personal use side of it. I don't think it has any. That's the biggest reason for it.
Okay. Senator Mock, quickly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. McCormick, I know that a number of other states have had the enhanced driver's license, and I think this is a relatively new thing. Have doing the research to try to move this forward in Minnesota. Has there been any lessons learned from how other states have implemented it? What are some of the, are there any adverse consequences that we ought to be thinking about? Are there things or other challenges that other states are facing that we ought to be thinking about as we're considering moving forward with this in Minnesota?
Mr. Chair and Senator Moi, I have not heard of any other than ensuring that you're making it that any type of contract that you're getting into in terms of an enhanced driver's license, you're making sure it's compatible with your current driver's license contract so that you're making sure that you're not adding additional costs and that we're certainly trying to make sure we are able to use our standard procedures and not do anything different, and obviously also trying to make sure we have good turnaround times and those kinds of things. And I think it's more upfront that the states need to ensure that their contract process goes well and that we're standing by what our constituents and our state want in terms of our agreement with the Department of Homeland Security. And I've heard that's gone pretty well in other states. So.
Seeing no more questions, Senator Skoy moves Senate File 345 as amended be passed and forwarded to judicial. Any final comments from the committee? All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, same sign. Motion's passed. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and committee members.
Senator Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome, Senator Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We actually have another driver's license-related bill in front of us, although it's good to be thinking we may be making changes anyways, because there apparently is a slight fiscal cost on this one, which we think could disappear if we're doing enhanced driver's licenses. You've got in front of you Senate File 1040, and the purpose of this bill, essentially the bill is actually very easy. It would require that a driver's license or the ID card would have an optional checkoff for a designation if you're a veteran. And then it would also require that designation would be on the driver's license. And there's kind of three reasons behind this. And I will tell you that this was brought forward to me by one of our community police officers, John Justin, who couldn't be here today, who's a veteran himself. And I have with me today Colonel Eric Alness, who is going to testify on behalf of this bill. But we've been doing a lot of work together in our communities, trying to be figuring out with reintegration about how to be making our communities more friendly, how to be easing the transition, and frankly, how to be recognizing our veterans. So with this, first off, it would give somewhat, I guess, of a prestige factor, perhaps you could think of it as, that in many ways, if you're going to be writing your checks and showing your ID or in other places, people would see that you're a veteran and, frankly, could thank you. It's a very small way of thanking people, but without knowing, sometimes people don't have the opportunity to actually say thank you for defending our country. And it would carry over with subsequent years and renewal, so you wouldn't have to keep doing this time and time again. Now, one of the reasons why John Justin brought this forward to me is he said, you know, as we are, as a veteran myself, and coming into a number of situations, I don't know if a person is a veteran. And with so many people having returned from Iraq and Afghanistan right now, it was something that would be helpful. It'd be helpful knowing when I'm approaching them. It'd be helpful going into a domestic situation. And from a public safety standpoint, it would be helpful in terms of helping to perhaps diffuse a situation. You may recall a couple years ago there was a situation in Alexandria that there was a recently returned veteran that was a part of it. There ended up being a shooting incident as part of it. But the law enforcement officials had no idea coming into the situation that the person was a veteran. And just knowing that would have likely have impacted it. So, again, this is optional. The person could choose to do it or not do it, but we think that it will help law enforcement officials, and it will also help our men and women who fought for us to be getting some recognition that they deserve in turn. And I think Colonel Alness has a couple other thoughts about that.
Colonel Alness, please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Colonel Eric Alness, Department of Military Affairs. And when I initially received this bill, I thought it was a pretty nice thought. But then as I started reflecting on it deeper, I recognized that it was really beneficial. And then after I started talking with other people, I saw that this really had some great long-term potential. As Senator Clark mentioned, this is an opt-in requirement. So no one's going to be required to do it or precluded or forced into taking this, which is good because it'll be recognized as a good thing, not as maybe some punitive measure to identify them and single them out. So the opt-in provision here I think is very good for, again, highlighting that this is for a beneficial purpose. And then I can envision many instances during the course of everyday life where this designation can make a positive difference. And a couple just examples is linking you to services and benefits. As veterans come and go throughout and have to show their state identification or the driver's license card, whether it be at a county or at nonprofits or something like that, they see the veteran designation and say, oh, you're a veteran. Did you know we offer this service? or were you aware of this benefit that you might be entitled to, or for this discount when you're applying for a home loan? You know, there's all these things that come into that all of a sudden that veteran could take advantage of and would help them, him or her, be more successful and their family be successful in the future. The second point I had was access the gratitude of the citizens, and Senator Clark talked about that very well. He's talking just the simple, oh, you're a veteran, thank you for your service, and that's very good. And then the final thing I had down was the assist law enforcement. Again, Senator Clark talked about that, but I see we got a couple law enforcement officers here, and if they would participate in our reintegration training that we offer, they would know that we don't say let the veteran off, you know, give them a break, they just served hard. No, we don't. We say the thing to do is hold them accountable. They have to learn to adjust to get back. But what this does is help to identify, because not every veteran who's back has short hair like me. They might have grown it out or something. But if a law enforcement officer should see someone doing excessive speeding and then pull them over, see a veteran, find out they're a recent return veteran, they can help encourage them to maybe get some of the counseling or help dealing with some of their need for that adrenaline rush or maybe some other legal issues that came into play. Also, in case it is something that's more more serious type of law enforcement issue, that helps identify all the way through the prosecutory or judicial system what alternatives can be there, what can we do for training, what can we do for counseling that may help that veteran more quickly return to a productive lifestyle, maybe with an extensive probationary period, but again, addressing the root issue, not just punishing them for it. So, Mr. Chair, that concludes my testimony.
Thank you, Colonel Allness. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have to say I understand the sentiment. I find those arguments fairly unpersuasive. I think there are a number of folks in varying circumstances that would have, you know, a similar argument, you know, for law enforcement purposes. And you know, if we start going down this path, I can see the driver's license being used in lots and lots of ways that maybe, you know, aren't the most well advised. Like, you know, there are a lot of reasons that we'd maybe want to communicate things to law enforcement officials when they're dealing with individuals and their circumstances. I think maybe the answer is to educating law enforcement professionals. There's been a huge initiative in the city of Minneapolis on that subject with respect to mental health issues, and it's been very, very effective. But to use the driver's license for that purpose is, I think we're going down a path that we might want to think about.
Mr. Chair, Senator
Clark.
I understand what you're saying. You know, in some ways, I suppose you could be likening it to when there ended up being multiple license plates, not just recognizing our veterans, but other things. But I do think this is different. That part of this is because even if the law enforcement official has gone through the training, and we want them to go through the training, they're not going to recognize or know a situation they're walking into. And I've heard this from a number of people around the state talking about going into a domestic situation. If somebody has recently returned, they're not going to know that. Or, again, these folks have significant training in firearms, and they're not going to have known that either. And so there are certain situations that it could make a significant difference in how it's approached. The courts, judges, and others have also been talking to us about what tools could be available. And so this is a small thing, just like doing our organ donor is. And sometimes, you know, on the lighter side of it, I can see what you're saying, but as Colonel Allness was saying, you know, we're in a very different time and place than we were in the 70s. Sometimes we're looking for ways to just connect people and help them better know what's an opportunity for them, or help as citizens be able to recognize it. So I think we can know enough about how to not go down a slippery slope, as it were. But there's a legitimate tool here for law enforcement, but also an opportunity to make a difference for others.
Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Clark, I appreciate you bringing this bill forward. Colonel Allness, you stated that there are oftentimes issues regarding the reintegration of veterans back into communities, but I don't see anything in the bill that differentiates between a returning veteran or someone who's in the process of reintegrating back into the community and someone who, say, has been a veteran for the past 30 years. And I'm wondering, Senator Clark, if you thought about that issue and have any because it seems to me there's a big difference there, and the bill doesn't seem to differentiate.
Senator Clark. Actually, we did talk a little bit about that, aside from it also being kind of bulky, and then when does one transition in and out. But it's been interesting, the number of stories we've heard of somebody who was a Vietnam War vet who, frankly, was just fine for 25 or 30 years, and one day something snapped inside of them. I'm not saying they went off or anything. They just said, all of a sudden, my world changed. And so veterans, regardless of whether it's a recent really returned person, and that is the reason for us thinking about this at this time, but for veterans that have participated in other ways, it can be an issue there as well. And I'll tell you, you know, from a personal standpoint, two of my three brothers were in the Navy. Neither of them saw conflict. One was, I guess, kind of like former Governor Ventura, one of the kind of pseudo SEALs, and actually did some very interesting things and was in for 6 years. My other brother, they both went in when they were very young. My other brother, who is now 36 years old, was helicopter rescue. And with him in particular, he's been somebody who for a long time has really struggled with some things. He, between what they did with the POW training, waterboarding, among others, there's a lot of things he went through. Some people it impacts differently than others. He's off and on had some challenges that, depending upon the situation, would be good for somebody to know about. Again, both thanking him because he's very proud of being a veteran, but also knowing that there might be some extenuating or maybe just some, not extenuating circumstances, something to be thinking about. And perhaps Colonel Lawless has some other thoughts, but that's why, after talking to a lot of veterans, it was like, this isn't just about one group of veterans, it's about all.
Colonel Lawless.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Sieben. And when I looked at the bill, and I noted that it deliberately did not break out between the current era and other eras of veterans, and I thought that was a good thing, because one of the things we found through a reintegration process is that this provides a needed resource for veterans from all eras. And if someone happens to pull out a veteran ID card from a World War II veteran, see their veteran, say, thank you for your service, you know, that helps that old guy or gal feel pretty darn good. And plus, the other important part is just that happenstance of linking up with essential services or a benefit that they weren't aware of, that's important for all veterans. So I don't want to pass by that, because I think that's a very important part about those happenstance chances that make that critical link that help improve the life of a veteran and their family. And I think that's something critical we'll find over time. We'll hear stories about that where, because of a thing like this, that helped the life of an individual and their family.
Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Clark, I have two questions. One, I'm looking at the fiscal note, and I'm trying to find a place on here on where they would pay extra for this designation to pay for the cost of it.
Senator Rest, we're actually going to be working with the department on eliminating this fiscal note, because we believe the whole reason is because they're going to have to change a form, and we believe that once they have to change a form for another reason, these costs go away. It's a one-time cost. It's just about the form. They've even put down reprinting 1 million forms. Well, if we need to wait until the next time they do the forms, there shouldn't be a cost. And so that's one of the things that Colonel Alnus and I and some others are going to be working on. Actually, when it first came to me, the thought was that we reduce the cost as a thank you, but we can't afford that. So I assure you, Senator Rust, we are looking for ways to modify that, because, again, I was told it was a one-time only charge.
Senator Rest.
But, Mr. Chairman, Senator Clark, you mentioned the special license plates, which are also voluntary. Some of them are veterans' license plates, and people pay extra for them for that. And I just wonder why you wouldn't have that. If somebody wanted veteran, I have another question too, by the way. But if somebody wanted veteran on their driver's license, why wouldn't we increase the driver's license fee for that privilege?
Mr. Chair, it's not a rest in part because we're trying to do this as a law enforcement mechanism. So there actually is a benefit to the public for doing this. Again, it's a one-time cost because of changing the form. If they're going to change the form anyways and make new copies of the form, I'm not really sure why the veterans should be the ones bearing the burden of the cost for printing the forms. So we're just trying to see if we can make it go away. Otherwise, Senator Russ, we will look for a way to go ahead and pay for it.
So, Mr. Chairman, Senator Clark, this is not like special license plates. I think you probably do not want to – I don't know if it was you or Senator Dibble that made that analogy, but I would certainly stay way, way away from that.
Yes. Madam Chair, my only reason for bringing
Senator
it up
Clark.
Is that everybody and their mother wants a special license plate now. So I was trying to address a slippery slope argument. We don't want it to be where we're having
like
a plethora of designations on a driver's license. There is a specific reason for doing it in this case, and I agree with you, Senator Rust.
Then, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rust.
I have a question born out of my own ignorance. To serve in the United States Armed Forces, do you need to be a citizen?
Mr. Chair, Senator, no, you do not have to be in the citizen to be in the Armed Forces.
So, Mr. Chairman,
and
Senator Clark, so legal immigrants who have been in the armed services could get a driver's license that says veteran on them.
And Mr.
Senator
Chair, Senator Rust, if they serve
under your
for
bill.
Our country, yes.
Their citizenship status is not an issue. So, too, for those who are foreign nationals who were in the armed forces of a country that was allied with the United States. I'm looking at the last page of your bill. Those folks could get a driver's license that said veteran on it as well if the Commissioner of Veterans Affairs said yes. And would that include people who are here on visas?
Senator Clark.
Mr. Chair and Senator Rust, this language, excuse me, came from counsel. So I believe that that's who gets the designation
then I would
right
ask
now as veteran.
Counsel,
Senator
to
Rust.
Explain that. Would that include a person who had fought for a foreign national and fought for another country, but an ally of the United States, who was here, let's say, on a visa to attend the university? Would they be eligible to get this driver's license that said veteran on it?
Ms. Berezovsky.
Mr. Chair and Senator Rust, probably Ms. McCormick could answer that better, but my understanding is as long as they qualify for a driver's license, which requires legal presence in the United States, it does not require citizenship, but requires legal presence. As long as the person qualifies for the driver's license, they would be able to get the veteran's designation if they had the appropriate documentation of service.
Okay, thank you.
Senator.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Bonoff first.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, Senator Day, they had, Senator Day, they had just called on me previously. Mm. That was why. Wasn't any other reason. Anyways, Mr. Chairman, Senator Clark, I appreciate the bill, and I support the bill because I think that there was a time, you know, when we were growing up and people were coming back from Vietnam where they did not experience being welcomed, appreciated, and acknowledged. And that is a very dark time in our history. And so now I think those of us who grew up during that era feel very strongly that that will never happen again, and that those members of our society who are serving on our behalf bravely and sacrificing ought to be appreciated and acknowledged. And so this is such a tiny thing to both serve their needs should there be problems, but more importantly, to appreciate and acknowledge the contribution that our military have made to us. So I thank you for the bill, and I support the bill.
I need to say something after that mention there. My best friend came back from Vietnam wounded, and he came back with all of his gear, wearing his jungle utilities a couple of months after he was back. He'd let his hair grow, and I was with him when we went into a 3-2 bar on Snelling Avenue, and we got kicked out, not because of me, but because of him. So he was a veteran. He was a wounded veteran. He looked like a veteran. He was not asked for his ID. And so I don't know if the ID actually makes a difference in a case like that. We got thrown out of a bar because he had long hair.
Mr. Chair, that probably reinforces Senator Bonoff's point about being in a very different place, because hopefully he would never face that again.
Hopefully that's true, yes. Senator Day.
Mr. Chairman, I'm a veteran, and I don't know if I've been thrown out of any bars. But I've been probably asked to leave a few times. I guess one of the first questions I have, do we have any other designations on our driver's license besides, you know, age,
organ
weight?
Organ donor.
Do we have any?
Organ donor.
I mean, I'm a veteran, but I don't get this. Why would we want to put, I mean, law enforcement wants to look at something, and I would think they'd want to look at something relatively quick and fast, and for us to start into this, and I can see the organ donor because we understand that accidents are right there and they're there. But, I mean, we're just opening up something that my buddies that are veterans, I can't imagine them saying I'd like to have that on my driver's license. But I guess the question is, I think we're opening it up to what's next, you know, to somebody's an astronaut, or I can, by being in Minnesota, we probably will have a teacher designation on there relatively quick. I don't know. Doesn't make any sense to me. I guess that's all I can say. I'm a veteran, and I just don't understand why we would want to do that on our driver's license.
Colonel Allness.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, I certainly appreciate the concern about the slippery slope, and that's something that's been mentioned. One thing we do a pretty darn good job of is of the National Guard members in the state, when they come back to help ensure that they get the training they need and linking up with resources and so forth. But the nature of the reservists, the Army reservist or Air Force reservist coming back, where they have commands from many different states, for the active duty members, when they come off active duty and come back to small town Minnesota and they don't have the support network out there, if there's a need for them to link up with services, a lot of times it's hard for them to ask. But if someone could see a visual identification or a tool to help get that link, to make that first step, that's where this could really help out an individual to get the training they need to be successful. And in no way do I want to say that all people coming back broke. Also, it's a tool for that person to come back and maybe feel a little bit down, and someone sees that and say, hey, thanks for your service. That alone, too, can help buck them up and help make them get to the next step or continue to be successful. Or say you're a veteran, you know, we have an opening on a local board, and through our local Yellow Ribbon community thing, we heard challenge veterans to do something excellent. How would you like to be on one of our local boards and be twice a citizen? That's the kind of thing that can come from this as well.
Mr. Chair.
One question now for you, Senator Clark. I think you're going to answer also. But the designation, I'm not sure if I'm viewing this correctly, but in the bill it appears like it's being compared to the organ donor blank, that it's a yes, no. So it's really a field that gets an embossment on it. It's not a card that says veteran across it.
Right, Mr. Chair.
Senator Clark.
So two things. So that point, it would have a designation on it that showed you were a veteran. Again, optional. So my guess is that Senator Day's friends would choose not to do that. They may change their mind, but they may not. I think a lot of the men and women that are at my local VFW very well might. So I'm not really sure about that. The other thing you should know is that law enforcement wouldn't have to actually see the driver's license. They would be able, once this was checked off, they would be able to bring it up on their screen when they're coming into it. So the designation on the hard copy license, I think, makes a difference for people. But what's important from a law enforcement standpoint is that they'd have the ability to bring it up and know it when they're walking in.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator I appreciate the bill too, and I you know that you know I'm doing things in my district, Colonel Allness. You know that I'm doing a lot of things with reintegration as well. I do share some concerns though, as Senator Dibble and Senator Day have talked about, and especially if it's in terms of law enforcement. It seems to me that you know a lot of the issues that might be associated with returning vets currently is you know PTSD or a mental illness type of thing. And as Senator Dibble talked about with mental illness in Minneapolis and trying to address those issues with education, you know, I'm concerned about that, you know, there'll be, even though you've said that it wouldn't happen, that there'll be, because there's this designation of veteran, they'll be treated differently necessarily than other folks that might be violating the law and, you know, whether it's speeding or whatever it might be. And that, you know, now we're going to want a designation for those who have maybe mental illness, or maybe it's, we want a designation for doctors so that they're treated in a different way if they get pulled over. I'm a little concerned that, law enforcement, a lot of law enforcement officers are former veterans, you know, now they see that they need some special treatment because they've done something. Now, you know, maybe if they have long hair, they you know, it's treated one way versus they have short hair, but now they see the designation, and that concerns me a little bit that where this goes. I mean, it's a good intention, but I'm not sure that, you know, in practical sense, whether or not this is the way we want to go. Can you give me some more reassurances that how you see this playing out from your standpoint when you've been thinking this through?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I guess we just look at demonstration about how effective that the reintegration effort has been by engaging the law members of law enforcement and providing training where we say the most important thing is to hold people accountable to the letter of the law and not do that. And I think that word's getting out to law enforcement throughout the state. And combined with the knowledge that that is the right action to do is hold people accountable, seeing the veteran designation is not going to give them a different standard. What it's going to do is hold them to the right standard and then possibly encourage them to say, you know, you were going real fast, and if you're a recent veteran, if it's maybe obvious or the person admits to it, then maybe they can encourage them to go off and get some additional help or training or something like that to see what else is going on rather than just, you know, I don't see anything we've said or anything that we've heard back from our law enforcement partners is that they are, yes, following that. They're holding people accountable. And statistics for the members of the Guard are supporting that. We don't have some of the negative rates that you hear about from other areas in traffic violations and so forth, because we're working in partnership with law enforcement to hold people to the standard.
Thank you.
All right, I think that we need to be voting on this bill here. So, Senator Clark, you're going to take care of this fiscal note for us, right? Okay, good. Senator Koch, you want to move the bill?
I'll move the bill.
Okay. Senator Koch has moved that Senate File 1014 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. Further discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion does prevail.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Dahl, you have Senate File 1028.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Pleasure to be in front of you today. I'm here really on behalf of the good people of New Prague, and this really is kind of a last resort. And so we're asking you to hear us out for a few minutes to maybe help resolve a little issue for us. New Prague, the community of New Prague, holds its annual Dozinki Fall Festival. And I'm Norwegian, so excuse my pronunciation of Dozinki. The festival attracts thousands of people every fall, and it's really an opportunity for New Prague to present itself to all of Minnesotans, but also visitors from around the world. And this process of actually shutting down Highway 19 begins Friday evening, and it goes till Sunday morning. And they have been doing this for about 25 years, I believe. We have recently received a note from MnDOT that they would like the city of New Prague to shut down Highway 19 and only allow them to be open at 4 hours at a time. Representative Laura Broad, a New Prague resident, and I have both written a letter to MnDOT. I know Representative Broad and myself have sat down with Jim Swanson, traffic engineer from District 7 of MnDOT, one of the most personable guys I'd ever want to meet. However, they believe that after 25 years that they want to enact a change in the way they have been in enforcing their current traffic engineering manual. A piece of the engineering manual actually, I think, allows for them to kind of grandfather New Prague in, and I don't think you have this in front of you, but I'll read it. Closures may be allowed at the discretion of the district office, subject to the following criteria. Closures shall not be allowed during peak traffic periods unless authorized by the district traffic engineer. The period of time for which a road is closed should not, and the word is should, not exceed 4 hours. But again, this is something they've been doing for years, and it's now that they're finally trying to enforce it. Before I introduce my two testifiers here, I also want to acknowledge that New Prague resident, Bob Vanasek, he is the current Honorary Consul General to the Czech Republic for Minnesota, Iowa, North Dakota, and South Dakota, is also in the room, and he's supporting us on this particular particular bill. So,
and we even have his picture in the handout that just...
Many famous people come from New Prague. Right. So with that, I'll turn it over to, I think, Christy Mock. She's the head of the Chamber of Commerce in New Prague.
Mr. Chair, oh, go ahead.
Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Christy Mock. I live in New Prague, and I am the executive director of the New Prague Chamber of Commerce. In September of this year, New Prague will host its 25th annual Dojinki Festival. In what began as a small celebration of the town's heritage and agricultural roots has grown into a two-day event welcoming nearly 15,000 people and including foreign dignitaries. In order to accommodate Dojinki, protect the attendees, and ensure the safety of all that come, the city and the Chamber of Commerce have requested road closure of Main Street or Highway 13 and 19 for the weekend from MnDOT. In each of the past 15 years in making that request, we have received permission. Upon requesting road closure this fall, MnDOT informed the city that they would not allow the extended road closure for the weekend again, and they expected New Prague to adhere to the closure rule that Senator Dahl just mentioned. We recognize that this would extremely cripple, if not destroy, our quarter of a century-long community celebration. So we appealed to MnDOT District 7 Transportation Engineer Jim Swanson and sat down with him as well. New Prague does not have a parallel road system or a space large enough to accommodate the festival as it currently is. Without the extended road closure, our vendors would not be able to set up along Main Street and stay that way for the 2 days of the festival. And much of the character and integrity of the event lies in the fact that Main Street in New Prague closes the downtown area as festival goers can enjoy themselves in our central business corridor. It's one of the characteristics that makes Dojinki unique and what draws people to New Prague from around the world. Safety is the key to the success of Dojinki, and New Prague has received, as I mentioned, approval for the weekend road closure when we were part of MnDOT's Metro District for 10 years and for the past 5 years as part of MnDOT's District 7 in Mankato. I have letters of support from both the Scott and Lee Seward County Sheriffs attached, as well as local business and community leaders supporting the extended weekend road closure. And in conclusion, I'd like to say that it may be Highway 1319 to MnDOT, but to residents of New Prague and our businesses, it is our main street. And we respectfully request that Mr. Chair and members of the committee recommend passage of this legislation.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I also have Mark Vosepka, the police chief from the city of New Prague.
And Chief, we got to shorten her up here, so if you can be direct and to the point and tell us that this is not a safety hazard, that'd be great.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair. First off, Mr. Chair and committee members, excuse me, my name's Mark Vosepka. I'm Chief of Police for New Prague. And to get to your point exactly, yes, I have been involved with the festival since I began my career for the last 24 years. It has evolved from a street opening event or when the street was open because of safety concerns, that as the event got bigger, Along with MnDOT, we decided to close down the roadway, and then over the years, starting in 1997 is when it is under the current road closure it is. We work hard to make sure the event is safe. We enlist the support of the two local sheriff's departments, provide us with approximately 25 extra officers to help us. I can honestly say that we looked over alternatives. The only way to make this event safe is to keep the road closed for the time period that we've currently been operating under with MnDOT's permission. Otherwise, I would not be able to sit here today and tell you that. It's been handled well, and we hope to continue as we are now.
Thank you, Chief.
Unless there's someone to speak against this bill, that's the only testifiers we have here today, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the bill.
Thank you. Pardon?
I'd like to move the bill, if we could.
All right. So we've got a motion in front of us here. I think that MnDOT, does MnDOT want to make a, Mr. Peterson, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Scott Peterson with the Department of Transportation. And MnDOT does have some concerns about this bill. What you have heard already is an accurate assessment of the situation. MnDOT had granted weekend closures for this festival for many years. And they did notify the city this year that they would like to discontinue that weekend closure. But they did also state that they would allow the weekend closure for the next 2 years to give the city time to work out an alternate arrangement for their festival. From what I understand, from talking to the folks down in District 7, their concerns are that the population in the region has grown considerably over the last 15 years. The traffic on Highway 19 in that area has grown considerably, and as a result, it has caused them to kind of reconsider whether this continues to be a good idea, diverting that traffic onto other roads that are not well suited for or designed for. The types of traffic that travel on Highway 19 are a concern to them, and although they don't necessarily have evidence that it causes safety problems, they are concerned that it may cause safety problems as things move forward and that area continues to grow. And as you heard, our policy on road closures for trunk highways does suggest a four-hour time limit for temporary road closures of highways.
Well, thank you. Chief, did you, or?
Go ahead and introduce yourself quickly.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Mike Johnson. I'm the city administrator for the city of New Prague. In response to that, the alternate detour route that you see on your map is a county road with Scott County. It's a 9-ton road, and it has in the past adequately served as a bypass. It's been acceptable to MnDOT. We ensure that the signage that goes up is approved by MnDOT. We also coordinate local internal traffic with the road closure, and as our police chief indicated, is that we've not had any significant accidents, injuries, or problems associated with that detour. And then finally, MnDOT has allowed it for the last 15-plus years, and we'd certainly like to see that to continue. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee? Senator Dahl has moved that Senate File 1028 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Senate floor.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Dave.
I don't have any problem with what we're doing. Oh. The question is are they going to have to come back again next year? I mean, should we do a 2 or 3 year deal instead of just a 1 year deal, or can't we do that? Or
Council says that very first line there it says annual, so they'll be good from now until they decide not to do the festival, I suppose. On the Dahl motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
All right, Senator Gimsey, there's one bill before yours yet. We had to make a small arrangement here.
going to take up Senate File 454. Senator Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 454 was brought to me by the petroleum industry, the jobbers, Mr. Krogman, who is on his way here. And now, members, this bill costs us a little bit of money, but in the long run, we can negate the cost of the fiscal note. Primarily what's going on here is the federal government and the state of Minnesota require a certain decal, and I'll let Mr. Krogman explain it here in a second. But we do this on several different types of vehicles that we've got out there. We've got this duplicative type paperwork thing going on and different stickers. And my thought is that the USDOT said it's okay, and we always play by the same rules that they do. Why then do we have to do the same thing that they did to put another sticker on just so we can collect, I don't know, $20 or whatever it is? But anyway, what this does is it removes the hazardous material sticker from us having to give it out.
Please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bob Krogman. I'm with the Minnesota Petroleum Marketers Association. We operate a lot of trucks hauling hazardous materials, gasoline, diesel fuel, delivering it to various places. Okay. What this would do is repeal this state form. It asks who you are, where you are, number of trucks you have, and what you're hauling. There's also the state hazardous or the federal hazardous materials registration form, which asks the same things: who you are, where you are, the number of trucks you have, and what you're hauling. There's also, Minnesota law requires everybody to get a USDOT number, which asks who you are, where you are, the number of trucks you have, and what you're hauling. Last year, the state authorized Minnesota to become part of the Unified Carrier Registration Form, which asks who you are, where you are, doesn't ask what you're hauling, just says how many trucks do you have. The fee on this form is anywhere from $3,900 to $39 for one truck. The DOT number doesn't have a fee. The hazmat, federal hazmat registration has a fee for small business of $275 up to $1,200 for a larger business. The state fee is $15 a truck plus a $50 filing fee for intrastate and $30 a truck plus a $50 filing fee for interstate. If you're at a roadside inspection or there's an audit at your office, they use the federal databases to look at who you are and what all your records are. This is the hazardous material or the federal safety regulations. That requires placarding, shipping papers, emergency response phone numbers, emergency response planning, various identifications for hazardous materials. This doesn't repeal any of that. It repeals only the state form. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Murphy, I believe you had an amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
The A2 amendment?
A2 amendment, and I would move the A2 amendment.
Senator Murphy moves the A2 amendment. All in favor, say aye.
Mr. Chairman, can we see it?
This coming, Senator Rest. Primarily technical changes requested by MnDOT.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest. This is
Senator Burns.
Technical cleanup.
Any questions on the amendment? Senator Murphy has moved the A2 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, same sign. Motion passes. Senator Murphy. Senator Rest.
Senator Murphy, Mr. Krogman, why do we have to have a hazardous hazardous waste registration either?
mean, does the federal government require that? Why does Minnesota need a separate program for that? Do they need a separate program for that?
Mr. Krogman.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, I've been told by the phone conversation with folks at DOT that they wouldn't be adverse to the whole program. About 7% of the registrations are hazardous waste. We don't have any hazardous waste haulers, but they also register as a request on the form with the EPA to get an ID number, with the Pollution Control Agency to get an ID number. They also have to register at the federal hazmat and get a U.S. DOT number.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rest.
Senator Murphy, why wouldn't you just repeal both of them? I mean, I read that there are only 298 that are hazardous waste carriers, and if they have to register all that with the federal government, why do we need a separate program for them either? I mean, maybe we do, but why?
Mr. Chairman and
Senator Murphy.
Senator Rest, you're right. Why? And we wanted to kind of start off and get the camel's nose under the edge of the tent and then take on the rest of it, because I think that there's a lot of work here, and Mr. Krogman just showed you the tip of the iceberg here. But I do believe...
Mr. Chairman, Senator Murphy, I hope you'll consider...
Senator Rest.
...when this bill...
Mm-hmm.
Whatever the future of this bill is, whether it stays in the committee mm-hmm. or becomes part of an omnibus bill, that
right.
looks like to me there's real justification to getting rid of this duplication at the state mm-hmm. level. If all it is money for a decal or money for a form, that's like the mm-hmm. Decals that we got rid of on the airplanes. We really didn't need them anymore, you know? The identification was done otherwise and in mm-hmm. a much more accurate and sophisticated manner. So mm-hmm. I would encourage you to, maybe not right this minute, but to talk with DOT and get rid of the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Senator Murphy.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Ress and committee members, what my intention with the bill was is to get it heard here so that everybody was exposed to kind of this duplication of services, set it on the table until we can work on the fiscal note, because it does have fiscal impact, and then see if there's a way that we can broaden the scope of it to take in more of the duplication that's going on. But so,
thank you.
That's where we're at. And Mr. Chairman, I would make that motion to put Senate File 454 as amended on the table.
Senator Murphy moves Senate File 454 as amended, is laid on the table. Any discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign. Motion passes. Senator Gimsey. Senate File 287.
Senator Gimsey.
Mr. Chairman, members, appreciate the opportunity to introduce you to Senate File 287 and to begin the discussion concerning our school bus transportation system and the unmet needs that are out there. As I reflect on the month or so since I introduced this bill and the amount of feedback that I've received from school superintendents, school board members, teachers, and even some parents about the positive effects that this bill could have on our school districts and our school system. It's just been very encouraging to me. I have a packet with probably about 50 emails and letters that from school board members that view this very positively and want the discussion quite badly about the needs of our school districts as far as when it comes to transporting our students to school and back. Senate File 287 is what we call STI, the Student Transit Initiative. It is a discussion about how we can set school transportation as a priority in the state of Minnesota. It's going to require all of us to not just think outside the box, but to get outside the box, look back in, and see what tools we have that we can use to make sure that the kids in the state of Minnesota are transported to school and back safely and efficiently. In tough financial times, our schools are making extremely difficult decisions. Many times they're increasing the distance that kids are having to walk to school, creating an unsafe condition for our kids, and requiring them to cross dangerous streets at times. And I don't think that this is a priority for us or something that we want to continue to see as a practice. And as budget times get even worse, I think we want to go the other way, where we're providing as much service as possible to our kids. Our schools are delaying purchases of buses that are getting older. We had one superintendent that was saying that they're using 1983 buses that have well over a half a million miles on them, and they're having a difficult time just maintaining those buses and making sure that they're safe as we move forward. I had 5 testifiers from school districts out in western Minnesota that were lined up to be here today. They aren't able to because of the weather, and I guess personally I'm glad that they're not. I wouldn't want them to be out there on unsafe roads. But we do have Brad Lindell here to testify on the bill. But I want to just run through the bill quickly for you. And each of you will notice that there's a packet, a personalized packet for each of you, that describes for you how much money this bill would mean to each of your school districts and how much they would receive under the provisions of this bill to offset some of their student transit needs. Section 1 of this bill defines public transportation, pupil transportation, as a transit purpose and public transit for public transit assistance. The next part of the bill is the tough part of the bill. This is where we call for different accounts within the transit funds to contribute money to the Department of Education to be distributed to our school districts. Subdivision 1 calls for the transfer of $5 million from the Greater Minnesota Transit account to the Commissioner of Education. Subdivision 3 requires the $45 million comes from the Metro Area Transit account to the Commissioner of Education. And Section 2 calls for $50 million to be distributed from the County's Transit Improvement Board to the Commissioner of Education. And in your packet, you'll also notice on a sheet that has a bunch of little school buses on it, just how these funds would be allocated and then distributed. And you'll see that through the motor vehicle sales tax, the funding goes to the transit assistance funds, which are the Metro Transit and the Greater Minnesota Transit Fund. And then the CBIT, which is the County's Transit Improvement Board, receives their funding through the quarter cent metro sales tax, which is 5 of the 7 metro counties that have agreed to be a part of that. And that money goes into the Transit Improvement Board and then to the Department of Education. From there, the Department of Education allocates it on a per pupil basis across the state of Minnesota. For every student, we estimate that it would be about $137 per student. Just a little bit of background on this. There are an average of about 240,000 boardings on Metro Transit buses and trains each day. Our school buses across the state of Minnesota transport about 730,000 children every day for 1.46 million boardings each and every day. The percentage of Minnesota public school children that are transported is about 80%. So the need is great, and the need on the part of our schools is overwhelming them, and they're having to make changes that are affecting our classrooms and our children. And I think we need to have the discussion and start to find a way that we can change that and move forward. At this point, I guess I'd like to have Mr. Brad Lundell, my only testifier, testify to the bill.
Mr. Lundell.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Brad Lundell here today wearing two hats, one as the Executive Director of Schools for Equity and Education and the other as Legislative Liaison for the Minnesota Association for Pupil Transportation, which are both supporting this bill. Part of the delegation that was to be here today are members of C, and I'm very happy to speak for them in favor of this bill. It certainly has generated a lot of interest and a lot of discussion amongst school districts throughout the state. I think a lot of what the frustration of school district transportation comes from is the decision back in 1995 to roll the school transportation formula into the general fund. That has pitted the school transportation costs directly against other classroom costs. There is a part of the formula to deal with transportation sparsity so that some districts do receive more than the 4.85% for transportation, but there is no reserved fund or no mandate that districts reserve their money for transportation. This has caused transportation cuts throughout the state. I don't think there's any question about that. We've seen the 1 and 2 mile walking distances put in place. We have seen more and more fees for transportation for those children that can be charged fees. But generally, in many cases, it's created a wide array of transportation services that are available district to district and have caused some inefficiencies, but have also speak to some of the things that Senator Gimsey is talking about here. That school transportation, the school bus is the safest mode of transportation in the Western world. We are very proud of that fact in Minnesota Association for Pupil Transportation, and we think that getting as many kids onto school buses to and from school is a goal to work for. Obviously what Senator Gimsey has come here is quite controversial and certainly is something that is outside the box. But I would we're talking about a lot of things that are outside the box this year. I know that Senator Bonhoff is working with their shared services in the K-12 arena, but also I think we need to look at shared services outside and between units of government and between people providing similar services to look at where some efficiencies may exist and where some of these things might work together. These are unprecedented times. I don't think there's any question about that. I don't think we can tax our way out of this box that we're in. I don't think we can cut our way out of this box that we're in. I think which really makes what Senator Gimsey is talking about here, thinking outside the box completely, is something that at least needs to be looked at. Again, I operate under no illusions. I know that this isn't something that's going to the consent calendar next week. This is something that's going to be talked about. But I do think that what Senator Gimsey has done has put before you something that does need to be talked about. Again, I think of a few years ago, Senator Sandy Pappas had a bill that would mandate that St. Paul and Minneapolis carry a certain percentage of their riders on our students on MTC. Obviously, there were many of the same barriers between the schools and the Metropolitan Council and the MTC talking to each other and using kind of shared services in that regard. Met with great resistance on both parties and was something that never really came to be. I don't know if we have that luxury anymore. And again, we need to look, I believe, at ways that we can make things work together. Transit is a community tool. Schools are part of the community. And I think it's if we can find a way to use this tool across a broader range of the community, I think it's something that should be looked at. I would also say, just in closing, the school bus age issue is a huge issue. As part of the rolling in of transportation back in 1995, there was a school bus purchase levy that allowed districts who own their buses to depreciate their bus purchases over 8 years. That was taken away. And so what we've seen from that time, and all of us predicted it in 1995, is that the fleet would get older. And when you talk about whether or not you're going to retain a teacher or buy a new bus, retain two teachers or buy a new bus, generally you're going to retain teachers. That's not putting districts It just districts don't have the tools to update their bus fleets the way that they did back prior to 1995. So it is something I think that as we look forward, this is something that what Senator Gimsey has come forward with is something I do think that warrants further discussion and something that we certainly would like to join in with.
Mr. Lundell, before you start fielding questions from the rest of the committee, you know, I was around here when we made that move that took transportation off of out of its own category. And if I remember right, everybody was saying that that's cool because there's more money in the pot now. And if you want to erase the lines amongst some of these categorical aids, then that's okay.
Mr. Chair, you probably didn't talk to me that year. Opposed that both in Schools for Equity and Education and MAPT. We both opposed that rolling in. There were two categories that were rolled in. We felt that one of them was the rolling in of training and experience was one that we felt, although we had problems with it, we certainly could understand the logic of doing that. But the rolling in of transportation was something that many, many school districts opposed. And the group that in which I was a lobbyist for at that time opposed.
Well, here's my contention. You know, this is a transportation budget that is being siphoned off here and large numbers. And these are annual appropriations of $45 million. And, we're having a problem right now providing transit services all across the state. And, if we take this money away too, I mean, who's going to be standing there to tell the person that they're not going to get to work today or they can't go to the pharmacy today or the people that are disadvantaged? The blind, for example, that don't have the option of driving themselves, that rely 100% on public transportation, or the person who, may not be able to walk. Where do we stop not providing the service for those folks so that we can put more money into education? And I'm all for putting more money into education, but when we have people that can't get to work or the doctor or the pharmacy, or we have those people from the disadvantaged community that aren't able to enjoy the same things that all of us do around this table, the freedom of mobility, aren't we just robbing Peter to pay Paul? And shouldn't this money come out of the education budget instead of ours? I mean, those are the questions that I have.
Mr. Chair, and I can't argue with a single thing that you said. I mean, I believe that, there's the pie is only so big, and it's a question as to how big the pie is going to be and what the size of the slices are going to be. And I certainly don't think that.
No, we increased the size of our budget last year. We did that. Education needs to go out and get their own money is what I'm saying. The money that we raise, we want to build roads and provide transit services.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would say that, we've talked about in the education community about doing a constitutional amendment. And, I mean, we do have the constitutional guarantee for a general and uniform, thorough, and efficient method of public education.
How's that working?
Well, I was just going to say that, unfortunately, there was no tax system in place when that part of the constitution was put together. So we didn't have a 3/8 cents of a sales tax or whatever to go along with that. So I think that there are questions that would certainly need to be discussed within that. But I think that... I think what I'm picking up and that we need to look at transportation in a more universal sense. And I think that's to the point where we can use both entities to solve multiple goals, we need to look at that. Whether or not that works in the end is anybody's guess at this point. But this certainly, as I said earlier, this is the beginning of a discussion and certainly not something that we're just walking to the starting gate, and we may not even get there.
Well, Mr. Lundell, I appreciate your comments earlier when you talked about Senator Pappas's bill that, where we were trying to provide school children rides on public transportation, which, in my opinion, just absolutely makes sense. I'd hope that we would go in that direction, but right now we've got a bunch of questions here. Senator Gimsey.
If I could just follow up on one of the comments that Mr. Lundell made, you know, and to wholesale discount the discussion about whether we should include school bus transportation as a transit purpose, I think eliminates the possibility of the exploration into what federal funds might be available to us, to the state of Minnesota, if we designate them as a transit, a form of transit. There are other opportunities. I haven't had an opportunity to explore that avenue yet, but I'm sure that there are a whole host of opportunities that might be available if we were willing to make a bold move like this and actually recognize school bus transportation as transit. Mm-hmm.
Senator Bonhoff, and then we've got Sieben, Salzman, Dibble, and Rest.
Senator Gimsey, thanks for bringing this forward. And Mr. Lundell, it's nice to see you in a different committee. I'm used to seeing you in education. And I say thanks for bringing it forward because I think that you are on the right track when you raise the conversation about, you know, what is the relationship that should exist between public school transit and transit for the rest of our citizens. And I've been working on the shared services thing for about 3 years, and it began with the notion that transportation ought to be viewed on a regional basis. And so to that end, I've actually, in the interim, not this last summer, but the summer before last, sat down with Chair Bell and said, Chair Bell, how can we work together so that we can look at, you know, transit from a broader perspective? And I've talked to the rural folks about if we could use our school buses to pick up the seniors when they're not transporting children. And so there's a piece in my shared services bill where we have a consultant who's supposed to work with the districts to look at outside-the-box kinds of ideas of how we could leverage. And I think talking with transportation will end up being a key part of that discussion. Mr. Lundell, I haven't seen that you've supported my shared services bill, but nonetheless, I'm glad you referred to it. But so I think this bill, while it does raise the conversation in an important way, and I appreciate that, I think taking money away from transit is the wrong direction, because we have a vision in this committee, just like we do in the Education Committee, of providing transit for every person who would choose that. And so, but I think if we view this as an opportunity to work together and create a whole new strategy for moving people, whether they're children, seniors, or somewhere in the middle, then I think we can leverage our dollars, and I look forward to that creative conversation.
Thank you. Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Lundell. I have always appreciated your concern about equity for our school districts, so I'm surprised to see you here supporting this bill when most of the money that is raised from the metropolitan area but then distributed across the state. So I'm wondering why you'd be here to support this if $45 million, which is raised in the metro area, through the metro area transit account is then distributed throughout the State Department of Education and to school districts all across the state, how that jives with your concern about equity.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sieben, I would say, number one, that, I mean, obviously this is, we're here more about discussion as opposed to specific distribution patterns. We know that the Gimsey bill as written, I'm under no illusions that that is the way that it's going to be finally put together. I'm here saying that this is something that we need to look at, and that the districts, if someone wants to change the distribution patterns, I represent districts in both the metro and non-metro area.
Right, but Mr. Lundell, why then would you advocate that money that's raised from taxpayers in the metropolitan area be redistributed to people outside the metropolitan area who are not paying those taxes? So, in other words, the money that's being generated for CTIB is then going to be distributed across the state, even though it was raised within the metropolitan area.
Senator Gimsey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The fact is that the MVEST money isn't just Metro money. It's raised across the state of Minnesota by the sale of cars, and the taxpayers of the greater Minnesota have for years, through this transportation committee, funded light rail and Metro Transit through MVEST and their gas tax dollars and what?
No, there was no gas tax money spent on light rail.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You are right. You are correct, and I appreciate your correcting me on that. But rural Minnesota and other communities across the state have also contributed to the Metro systems. The other part of this bill, which is, if you read in your packet, is that over 50% of the money that is taken in by this bill is also redistributed on an equal basis at $137 per child that is transported. So the money is taken from one Metro Transit account, given to the Department of Education, but the Metro and suburban school districts have far more children that ride student transit than does rural Minnesota. And I think if each of you will look at your suburban districts that are on the letter that I wrote to you, you'll see that some of them get up into the millions of dollars. Well, my largest school district, Wilmer, gets $530,000. You know, it is distributed on a per pupil basis based on the number of kids that are being transported.
Well, Senator Gimsey, I'm going to let Senator Olson have the mic here. Half this money comes out of MVEST, half comes out of CTIP. Now, you know, those county commissioners here in the metropolitan area were the ones that put their election certificate on the line to help provide better transit services for their constituents. And, you know, you kind of have a spit and a handshake agreement with those folks that we won't rob their fund, because actually we could rob the fund if we wanted to. But, you know, I just don't think we should, myself. I mean, because we did make that agreement with the commissioners in the metropolitan area, so that might be a little difficult for some of us to go back on that. Senator Olson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I have the same concerns, and it isn't just $50 million. It's closer to $95 million that is coming out of the metro area. And that $45 million that is in the metro area transit account, some of it is MVEST, but as Senator Dibble says, it's our property taxes. It's out of the fare boxes for the Metro Transit. So a far more sizable chunk is coming out of the metro area for that. So it's I think that kind of just raises a red flag right from the beginning of redistributing. Some of the folks, and it's within the sales tax, that's only five counties within the metro area that are generating the other $50 million that you would like to have. So some people in Hennepin County are chafing not only from that, but having to pay for the Twin Stadium. So I suggest that maybe if people want a Viking Stadium, that perhaps the rest of the counties in the state should pick up that little extra sales tax and take care of that for us and leave Hennepin County out of it.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Now we have Senator Saltzman, Dibble, Restendahl. And then we need to get some more testimony on the record and get moving. So.
And on these same points, Mr. Chair, I do see that the metro area generates $95 million, and I do want to note that the quarter-cent metro sales tax only does come from five counties. Two do not put into that, and yet they would benefit. So when my county commissioners voted for this quarter-cent sales tax, they were voting for transit improvements in the metro area. We worked very hard to have equity in the East Metro area. And I would be it would be very concerning to me to take the money which they voted to impose in my county to use it for something else. And I'm very surprised because The three counties that are involved with this, Anoka, Washington, and also Dakota, represent many C school districts. And I have not been contacted by my school districts personally that they are in support of this bill. I will tell you that the transit improvements that we need to make get people to work. They get the parents of children to work. And I guess, Senator Gimsey, when I see the split of 95 Metro versus $5 million outstate, this would be very, very difficult for a suburban legislator to support. We already send many dollars to outstate. Perhaps you'd like to give up your ethanol money to fund transportation. I don't know if you support that or not, but there are people in my community who look at that subsidy as not really helping Minnesota. So I just share that I am disappointed that we've worked very hard to support transit in the most equitable way and build a system. But I am very concerned that this is the balance is simply not there at all.
Thank you. I need to make an announcement here right away. Senator Vandiver has pulled his bill, number 8 on the agenda, 1091, off of today's agenda. That's going to be put on the agenda for Thursday. He needs a little time to work that out. We're going to try to get this bill done and the next bill done. So if you're here for a bill for mini trucks or Senator Bonhoff, and I'm sorry because Ms. Vogel is here today, and I hope she doesn't tell her mom on me for making her come back another day. But and then number 9, Senator Dahl, your bill, we'll have to do those Wednesday night as well. So with that, where are we at? We have Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I was wondering if Senator Gimsey could tell us if he's read the recent legislative auditor's report on pupil transportation, and if he has, if he could tell us what some of those recommendations were.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, I haven't read it.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would recommend reading that legislative auditor's report to Senator Gimsey, and which he would learn that we are spending a lot of money on pupil transportation, and we rolled it into the per pupil formula, and that maybe wasn't a great idea, because what they found are a lot of districts are not running that function very effectively or very, very cost effectively. In fact, many school districts have no idea how much they're spending or what they're getting for their dollar. Their dollar's not accountable, and they're contracting with a lot of private providers who are charging them way, way more than they should. Maybe Senator Gimsey, would you consider maybe taking a look at that legislative auditor's report and maybe pulling together a bill that would respond to some of those recommendations that would give us a little more efficiency for our public dollar for pupil transportation?
Appreciate that, Senator Dibble.
And Mr. Chair?
Senator Dibble.
Wondering if Senator Gimsey has been following the proceedings of the Interagency Committee on Transportation Coordination that's been pulled together by the Department of Transportation, working across numerous agencies to take a look at all of our various transportation functions.
I haven't, Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, I haven't been a part of those conversations. Okay.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'd suggest maybe Senator Gimsey, we could take a look at that. At that work that's been going on for about 2 or 3 years, a lot of great recommendations for greater efficiencies in how we do our transportation function, fixed route, regular route transit service, human services transportation, pupil transportation, a lot of good ideas, a lot of good work. As a matter of fact, I've got a bill, and I'd love for you to co-author with me to maybe formalize that committee in statute and give them a little more legitimacy and a little more grounding in statute so that work can maybe take hold and we can get more and better out of our transportation function.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble, I very much appreciate your kind and courteous recommendations to me. Being relatively new to the Minnesota Senate, I will take that under advisement and as I certainly become more and more aware of all of the intricacies of this transportation system that we have in the state of Minnesota, I'm sure that I'll probably be much more aware of exactly what you're talking about. So thank you very much.
And one more follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, we've had our conversations, so you know how I feel, and, I probably would echo some of the comments of my colleagues when we stage a raid on funds that are generated in one part of the budget or one part of the state raises hackles and conflict and tension when we're all actually all here trying to solve problems. So, you know, I will not question your motives and believe that you're sincere in trying to bring more and better transportation to students, and that's a laudable and noble goal. But, Mr. Chair, we are going to hear from the departments. I think MnDOT and Metro Transit is here ready to respond to our questions. We can really understand the implications if we were to simply appropriate $95 million out of the metro area and spread it around the state and take $5 million out of the Greater Minnesota Transit account and divert it to another purpose in light of the budget deficits they already face. I think that would be interesting information for the committee.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes. Senator Gemsy.
And Senator Dibble, I very much appreciate the fact that you aren't going to call into question my motives because my motives are about the concern for our students and our school districts. I've been hearing from the superintendents and principals and the school board members of my district when gas hit $4 a gallon. It caused an extreme amount of stress for those folks, and I felt their concern.
Mr. Chair,
well, Senator Gemsy, I think what you're hearing here is a willingness from the committee to work with you. I think that some folks probably feel you're on the right track, and other folks feel that maybe not quite so much. But we all know that. Providing transportation services for our kids out in Greater Minnesota is eating up a lot of education dollars, and there ought to be a better way of doing it. So, why don't we move on here, Senator Rest?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rest.
Senator Gemsy, I don't think you have to defend your motives. I think absent this funding mechanism, which is a non-starter, I think it's an exciting idea that we look at. School bus transportation as part of the overall transit services in this state. I hope that the interagency group that you I don't know anything about them either, but I hope that they will take an idea like this and start brainstorming about how their expertise could inform school districts about how to run their bus systems more efficiently, whether they do it themselves or they do it through private providers. The notion of shared services, Senator Bonoff, doesn't just go this way. It can go this way, it doesn't have to be horizontal. It doesn't have to be vertical or horizontal. It can be even a crisscross thing. I appreciate the creativity in this approach. The money, the answer to that is no. It's plain no. But absent talking about the money, talking about the idea is something that this committee should be about, the Met Council should be about. They shouldn't just look at this chart. Tear this chart up. Not going to happen. But the idea is really very, very interesting. To be talking about a total transit transportation system. Why in the world, all of us that talk about intermodal transportation, would we ever even dream of leaving out school buses just because they're yellow? And the federal stimulus money going after that to buy green buses for our school districts, why aren't... Yes, let's do that. Let's hope that MnDOT or whatever agency it is that's supposed to be doing that does that. The money that's unfortunate because it distracts people from talking about your idea, which I think maybe it won't work. Who knows? But if you don't talk about it and try and get some depth to it and flesh it out, well, then we really won't know. So that's what I have to say about that.
Thank you, Senator Rest. I appreciate your comments.
Senator Dole first.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest said it very well. I don't need to add to that.
Yeah. So. Okay, then Senator Fischbach, Scoy, and Cole.
Mr. Chair, and Senator Gemsy, I'm a co-author on this bill, and I want to thank you for bringing it forward because I think you're trying to address an important issue in particularly in rural Minnesota that we have transporting our kids to school. And I don't see it as an attack on any kind of metro transit. And I think that you know, some of, I think that there's been this feeling like there's this attack on Metro Transit. I don't know if maybe the folks around the table understand what it's like when our kids have to make longer walks to school and it's cold. And, you know, one of my school districts that is listed here has just cut a lot of the buses back. And those kids are making longer walks. And I think that I appreciate, Senator Ress, what you talked about, you know, the whole package. But I also think that we are in difficult times and we do have to set some priorities. And I would absolutely agree with Senator Gimsey that this getting our kids to school is one of our biggest priorities, safely, not just getting them there, but getting them there safely. And I also I would be interested in Senator seeing the report that Senator Dibble talked about, because I think that as I've had discussions about student transportation in my area with my school districts, they have worked very, very hard to do it as efficiently and cost-effectively as they can. And so I'd be interested in seeing that, because it is they've contracted, they own buses, we have a variety of things, but I just really I don't see this as some kind of raiding or staging a raid on anybody's transit account. I see this as trying to work outside the box in these difficult times and make sure that kids get to school safely.
Well, Senator Fischbach, it probably would not have been perceived as a raid on Metro Transit if the $95 million hadn't been attached to it. But, I mean, anytime you start hooking millions and millions of dollars, people are going to squawk like that. We all know that. Senator Scoy, and then Senator Kolk, and then Senator Day.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Gimsey, perhaps later on this session you'll have the opportunity to support a little broader-based revenue stream that we can use for some of these transportation issues. But what I do want to say is I think Senator Rest is right. We should be looking at the little blue buses that are running around our rural roads and using them in conjunction with the little yellow buses. I mean, that just makes all the sense in the world. But I have to say, as I've looked at the transportation issue, and when we changed from the categorical in 95, which had a number of students and number of miles calculated into it, it was particularly hard for rural areas. And in your proposal here, we're just continuing to perpetrate the problem with the transportation funding. It's just total, every student gets paid the same amount. And when you have these large, diverse rural districts, and they do get some transportation sparsity, but it's not enough, when we do talk about transporting students at schools, we have to take into account the cost differential between driving, you know, 3 miles between kids and three houses between kids. And when you just have the funding going through a per pupil formula, it doesn't work very well. So as we move forward on this, and you know, for the rest of the members of this committee, those in the education community, I'd like everybody to kind of keep that in mind.
Senator Cole.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Gimsey. I'm just glad now I've seen the conversation turn a little, so my statements that I were going to make is maybe not as apropos. But I'm struck in hearing the first part of this hearing by the shared services initiative that we had in education. I'm glad you brought that up, too, because the conversation was the same. There were so many reasons why we can't do this. We didn't even think about what we could do. And so I am very glad you brought this forward. I hate to see us. I understand the concern about this funding stream. I get that. We all knew that going into this. But I think it's much more productive to bring up ideas. And Senator Dibble brought up the idea of the interagency, the county interagency report, which I don't know anything about either, Senator Rest. But it's much more constructive than sitting here questioning or not questioning people's motives, as it were. Than to have these conversations about what is possible. This is maybe not possible, but it's the start of a conversation, and I'm glad you brought it up, Senator Gimsey.
Thank you, Senator Gimsey.
I would not. That's the second time I've heard that. Who is questioning Senator Gimsey's motive?
Senator Dibble assured us he was not questioning his motives.
I'm not.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Yeah. Well, I thought he said he was not questioning.
That's
his.
What I'm saying.
Oh. Yes. That's right.
Okay.
Not questioning his motives.
All right, Senator Day. Let's. I'm going to question your
motives. Chairman. Mr. Chairman.
Nobody.
And Senator Gimsey. No. Thanks for bringing up your bill.
I don't think it has much of a chance. Just loved it. I've been in the minority for 18 years. I would like to do like Senator Rest. You don't have a chance. Never have I been able to
Mr.
do that.
Chair,
I wish I'd just once. I might have to stick around for 10 years. And to Senator Dibble, send me a book too. You know, we've been so busy worrying about you taking away our vehicles that we haven't had time to get to dive into some of these other areas. But let me end with this. You know, in Owatonna, we receive $5,140 less per student than Minneapolis does. $5,140. If you walk down the hallways in Owatonna High School and look in at each classroom, we receive $100,000 less than Minneapolis. So there are inequities in a lot of different areas, the way we put together school funding, and probably the as Senator Gimsey has brought forward something, and you know, maybe we will have to work that out. Senator Gimsey, my recommendation to you is next time you come here, you should have Racino on your bill. And we could give Senator Dibble $100 million, and you could have $100 million. So you could carry that bill. I'd let you do that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Day. Senator
Day. Well, Mr. Chair, well, Senator Day buys an electric car, he'll be in good shape.
Sun City West.
Yeah. So
not that old.
Yes. Yet.
Yeah.
I will promise to bring the report again to the committee, which I have presented previously in this committee, that shows some of the great ideas that the legislative auditor, some of the bad things that are happening, and some of the great ideas the legislative auditor has for us, and the interagency committee. Folks should know the great work that's kind of going on without our awareness. That's why I even introduced the bill. So that the legislature maybe could become more aware of the great work that's being done by our agencies, kind of sight unseen by us, and maybe give them a firmer foundation to stand on. There are some great ideas in both the reports of that committee as well as the legislative auditor's report. I'll bring that back to the committee, highlight stuff, make sure people are well aware of what's going on with our people transportation system in Minnesota, because it's pretty alarming, but there are solutions to be found.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair?
Senator Dole.
To that point, Senator Dibble, you're the chair of the Transit Subcommittee. Is this an issue you'll be looking at as well in that committee?
Mr. Chair, the chair and I work those out from issue to issue. We haven't had a big mass of transit bills. They've been kind of trickling in. That's why I've been dealing with them in full committee. But we could do that if you want to do that.
So, Mr. Chair, I'd just like to add that I hope I can testify here more because it's a lot more fun in here. Than
That's because we passed a bill last year. I tell you what I'd like to do here is we've got bills 6, 7, and 9 are going to be heard tomorrow evening, and the Vandeveer bill number 8 is going to be heard first thing Thursday, and then Thursday we also have two budget overviews to provide as well.
Is it tonight or tomorrow night?
Senator Gimsey, I think you've probably got a feeling that the bill's probably not going to go much further here. I would probably suggest that we put this bill on the table, and you work with Senator Dibble and some other folks and Senator Rest and see if there is a way to maybe bring this back without the money part on the back end. I kind of hate to cut off discussion, but we need to get to the LATS bill as well. But it's up to you. It's your bill, Senator Gimsey.
Mr. Chair, I do believe that the rest of the folks that will be testifying will be testifying against it, and I think we probably have heard enough.
I don't see them fighting to get to the bat rack, so unless there's any objections from the committee, Senator Gimsey, I'd like to put your bill on the table. All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail. Thank you, Senator Gimsey.
Right. just think it's fascinating how you guys, it's all about you.
And members, while we're while Senator Latz is coming to the table here, if you have any your paperwork that you don't want to keep after the committee, if you can push it to the front of the desk, that'd be great, because we're going to have to break down and get out of here in a hurry.
I mean, we're the same. That's
all right. Senator Latz, ignition interlock. Senate File 462.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you. Currently in Minnesota, we have a pilot program for an ignition interlock system in two counties, Hennepin County and Beltrami County. Ignition interlock is an electronic device that stops a car from being started unless the driver sitting in the driver's seat blows into the device and the device shows no alcohol in the driver's body.
We can get a few of the conversations in the back alcove to move out in the hallway. I'd appreciate it. Thank you. Senator Latz.
Thank you. The device was designed to find a way to allow DWI offenders to get driving privileges back sooner, yet still protect the public safety. Because as you know, they're currently in a DWI, their license gets revoked for anywhere from a very short period of time to an extended period of time, many years. It can be without even a work permit. So we are now, a year and a half into the pilot program, and we've had some interesting experience with it, and the Department of Public Safety and I, as the chief author of that pilot program, believe that it's worthwhile to take the pilot program to a statewide pilot program to make this available and see if we can work out the kinks in consideration of a long-term permanent state program. I have with me Jean Ryan from the Department of Public Safety. I'd ask you to hear her testimony as well.
Ms. Ryan, welcome back to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jean Ryan. I'm the Impaired Driving Program Coordinator in the Office of Traffic Safety in the Department of Public Safety. And through my role, I have been managing the ignition interlock pilot project in conjunction with the Driver and Vehicle Services Office. The current pilot project will expire July 1st of 2009, and this bill will extend that pilot for another 2 years, but it will also expand it statewide so we can really learn a little bit more about the instrument and how it works. Mm-hmm. I'd be happy to answer any questions anybody has regarding the current pilot project.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ms. Ryan, here's my question. There's a zero-cost fiscal note here, and I haven't read the fiscal note. Tell me why it's zero.
Well, Mr. Chair, the proposed bill will expand a pilot to continue on as a pilot project for another 2 years and expand statewide. Mm-hmm. Through a pilot, we're able to assist with implementation of this project with federal funding. And so the Office of Traffic Safety will be using National Highway Traffic Safety Administration funding to learn more about ignition interlock and possible implementation of a statewide program. Permanent,
excellent.
Which would not be fiscally.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee? Senator Rest.
Just a comment, Mr. Chairman, Senator Latz. 23 years ago, I authored the first bill to have ignition interlocks on our cars as part of a DWI bill, and people laughed. And I got reduced to a tiny little study, not even a pilot project. But I am really delighted that this has become so successful and that you're authoring this and that you want to take it statewide. Thank you for doing that.
Senator Fischbach.
Mr. Chair, Senator Latz, I am going to vote no, not because I just don't think that people have had their license revoked for drunk driving should be driving, period. You have your license revoked for a reason. You've done something wrong. And so I don't agree with any of the kind of the work permit, that kind of thing. If it's been revoked for that reason, I don't think you should have it. That's why I'm voting no on this.
Yeah. Senator Dibble.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, maybe a question for Ms. Ryan. So the press lately on ignition interlock is a campaign by MAD nationally to eventually require all cars be started with this new device. So whenever any of us wants to start our car, regardless, we have to prove that we haven't been using alcohol. Is that the goal of the Department of Public Safety to move to that eventuality or not?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, our goal is to implement improve public safety. As far as all cars, what I've heard about MAD's proposal, it really is researching the possibility of a new tool that would be non-invasive. That would, if a person is over a certain alcohol concentration, it would not allow you to start the car. That's there's a lot of research being done on that. That is really, it's going to need a lot more, not only research but new technologies that would be non-invasive, and it would be something that would prevent impaired driving. As far as that's my understanding of what that type of an instrument that would be installed in all vehicles at some point, I think that's MAD's proposal.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
So, is there musing within the Department of Public Safety that would be a good thing to have happen eventually in the coming years? Or is there no position?
I think that, there... Public safety is always looking for new technologies on what would improve public safety. So what that would be would certainly depend on what type of devices out there, what would be encouraged. I think that they're really working with manufacturers. At a manufacturer's level, it really wouldn't be a state level. It would be more of a manufacturer's federal level.
They already have technology where they can measure alcohol level through the skin. Mm-hmm. And so there's some people that are trying to put it into the steering wheel. Mm-hmm.
Chair, just for the record, I think that's a bad idea. I know I'm construing a lot out of this bill, but I've been kind of alerted to that issue or kind of sensitive to that issue. I think, there are points beyond which we shouldn't reach as government into people's lives, and I think that's getting a little too far into people's business.
All right. We've got a couple more questions here. Senator Latz, you had a comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just in response to Senator Fishbach's concerns, in your packet you have some materials from Mothers Against Drunk Driving, which strongly supports ignition interlocks. They actually support it for all convicted drunk drivers. Minnesota does not apply it quite that broadly. And some data on New Mexico's experience with regard to drunk drivers and repeat offenses, the recidivism rates, including crashes, injuries, and fatalities. One thing that MAD cites is that, as they put it, revoking driver's licenses is not enough. 50 to 75% of drunk drivers whose licenses are suspended continue to drive. So it's not the suspension that's key. I mean, they have to get to work or whatever their purposes are. And so their conclusion is that vehicle immobilization or license suspension is not as effective as interlocks in preventing DWI recidivism. So from a pure public safety standpoint, it doesn't do enough just to suspend their license. They're better off driving, because they're going to drive anyway. They're better off driving with a valid license, having insurance, and having the ignition interlock in place to protect public safety. And the data out of New Mexico fully supports those conclusions.
We have 3 minutes. Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's part of my point. I noticed that it's like, well, just putting them on suspension or not giving them a right to drive doesn't stop them, nor does it stop them from driving drunk. And I was looking at the first letter. It says that you've got proven a 64% reduction in drunk driving offenses. But then the next sentence says that only fewer than 10% of the offenders choose to have this device versus a suspension. Why would they do that? I mean, just because they know they can go ahead and drive again? Is that the deal? Mm-hmm. And they want to continue drinking? It's a conjecture, I know, but, 10% is, that's obviously, that's a very small number.
Senator Latz.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dahl,
There are a number of reasons why an individual might choose not to go with the ignition interlock. Some of it is the way the program works, and that's one of the reasons why we want to continue this as a pilot program, because we're continuing, the department is continuing to tool the incentives and disincentives to get in the program. It's certainly some imposition on the driver as a condition of it. They have to extend the length of the license revocation right now. There's still a waiting period before you can get a work permit under some circumstances. In some cases, you have to be part of an intensive supervision program within the courts, which doesn't make everyone eligible for it.
Okay, so, Mr. Chair and Senator Lass, I'm reading from this that most of the folks that get convicted of a drunk driving offense view this particular punishment harsher than just a suspension if they're not going to opt for it. It seems to me that they would rather that not to do this, so this seems like a better way to go.
Well,
than
go ahead.
Cool. That's fine. I just think that I like the program you've got here. It seems it's a good idea. And what we want to do is remind people what they're doing, their behaviors while in the car. And this gives an opportunity to actually do that versus just say take away your license. So.
Yeah, Senator Dahl, you know, not everybody that gets caught drinking and driving has an issue with alcohol. But a lot of the people who choose not to go through a drug or an interlock program or some sort of intense supervision, those are the people that actually do. They'd rather get suspended, go buy a car from the junk dealer, fix it up a little bit, steal somebody else's plates, and drive illegally. I think what Senator Latz and Ms. Ryan want to do is to try to improve the program to the point where that type of person decides to get into the program. Because obviously there's something wrong. And you know, just speaking from personal experience, if your desire to drink is that hard, then you're having serious problems inside your family. And, you know, it's going to take a lot more than a suspension or whatever to kind of get you back on the straight and narrow. Senator Saltzman, and then we're going to vote on the bill. Oh, you have nothing? Senator Carlson moves Senate File 492.
62.
I'm sorry, I'm on the wrong one. 462, I'm sorry, to be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Senate floor. Further discussion.
Mr. Chairman, Judiciary, I understand, has requested it. This is the note in my file.
Oh, you didn't, you haven't been there yet?
No, this is a committee
okay.
version.
That
the initial reference was changed from Judiciary to Transportation.
That's oh, okay. Yeah. All right.
We want to make sure we met deadlines. So.
Yes. Okay. Well, this bill is going to go to Judiciary then. On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails, and the committee is adjourned. Thank you, Ms. Ryan, Senator Latz.